Hey guys, coming up in just a second is the first episode of the conversation that we did on the radio station K-Chung, which some of you, many of you, are already familiar with. It's a sort of a rogue music slash talk, I guess mostly music station, that's housed in a secret studio in Chinatown area of Los Angeles. Anyway, wanted to just let you know that this took place on June 1st at 10 p.m. The first Sunday of the month is the time slot. I'm not sure if anybody listened because the towers were down at the moment, so you had to listen via streaming. And you will notice that there's a little background sound, which is music that was left on as transition music, and was not turned down by the engineers on hand. So apologies for that. It's not going to happen in the future. It's still totally audible, and it was a really fun conversation with Whitney Biennial vet, now Carl Handel, and my co-host Margie Schnibbe. So here it comes. Enjoy, and I will talk to you at the end of that conversation. This is the conversation. The K-Chung inaugural episode. This is Michael Shaw. I am joined tonight by Margie Schnibbe, artist and K-Chung veteran. Hello, Margie.
Hi, Michael. How are you this evening?
Fine, thank you. And we are joined by veteran of the podcast and recent Whitney Biennial participant and just come from the ticker tape parade in New York, Carl Handel. Hello, Carl.
Hi.
So,
ticker tape parade.
Yeah.
I can't believe you say that. Okay.
So Carl,
we're just getting right into it.
Yeah, exactly. Are you with the background noise and all?
I'm honored that I'm your first guest.
Yeah. Well,
this is your first live. This is live.
Well, it is live. Apparently, you know, live and recorded.
Yes.
So yes. In any case,
are you a little nervous?
I'm not so much nervous as distracted by the goings on at the chaos of K-Chung. Which you have experienced.
It's just like me, like doing the whole interview before the show even starts. Was that the chaos? Hey, it's a pre-interview.
No. I'm not. I'm actually just talking about the former DJ who
was.
Oh, come on! This is the way it goes here.
Okay. This is pirate radio.
I apparently am the virgin of the three of us. So that's pretty ironic. So Carl, why don't we start by talking about the biennial? So. See, I told you. We were talking about it earlier, but we're going to pretend as if we were not.
I didn't know that you were going to... I thought we were... First of all, I didn't know that I was the only guest. I thought your co-host was actually the other guest, and we were going to talk about bad studio visits. But we can talk about the biennial if you want to talk about it.
We could talk about bad studio visits, but we haven't had any, really.
Yeah, we haven't had any.
So we can talk about the biennial because that's actually, like... It's exciting. I say, as an artist, I think it's amazing that you're in the biennial. It's something that many, many artists really would love to participate in that show, and I think it's really cool. And I think it's great. And I would want to know as
Thank
an
you
artist,
for saying that.
Yeah, what it's like to be in it. I went to the biennial, I saw your work, I watched the video and the Whitney about how the process of making your work, and I...
Well, Margie, for those who haven't been to the biennial nor seen that video, would you like to give a really quick recap of what Carl's section was like?
Well, with the black and white, the graphite drawings, right? And I thought what was really cool is that you explain your process online.
Oh, on the video, yeah.
Yeah, so people can see that. And that's really generous. And I think it's really cool, like amazing.
I didn't come up with the idea to do a little video. They send a video crew around, you know, and then, of course, I say yes to everything. So if someone says, can we come to your studio and make a video for our website? I say, sure, no problem.
Well, the thing, you know,
the thing that
brings up for me is the fact that this video is being made because there's going to be a much wider audience than you get for a lot of museums and a lot of shows, presumably. And... So, I mean, is that not part of your perspective? your scope at all? That the fact that, you know, you're going to get a much bigger
a lot of your work. Yeah, a lot more people see this show than, you know, gallery shows, and
or museum shows in Los Angeles,
or museum shows in Los Angeles. I've been in some museum shows in New York. People see those, but of course, there's a different kind of thing with the Whitney. I would say that maybe if you're in a museum show at a different museum, or it's not such a high-profile show, people might see it during the run of the show, and a lot of people see the Whitney Biennial. A lot of sort of the important people see it the night of the opening, which means they don't see it at all. It was the most insane opening. It was just insane. I mean, the line was around the block. I even had to wait to get in, even though I was in it. You know, and then people are just like, oh God, you know, trying to get in.
So this is a very big deal.
And it's the big deal. Like when you get your invite for, so it's like, if you're super, super important, you get it for like 6. I didn't get that. I got the 7 o'clock. The artist got 7 o'clock.
Right.
Then the normal people get 8:30.
So it's the,
Dave Kordansky somehow, I mean, if there's one person in the world who can get in, he had an 8:30 and cut in line in front of us at 7, and we were like, Dave, you're never going to get in. He's like, I'm getting in. He got in. I don't know how he did it.
So Dave had 8:30, so the next time I see him, I can give him shit. I'm like, dude,
no,
you give him six,
but I don't know, but he got in at 7, so you should give him, props for managing to get in at 7.
Of course he got in.
Well, what do you think he did to... I don't know.
Charming. He got in. He can get in. He's good. I could have never got in without the invite. I'm lucky I got in at 7, even with the 7 invite. Oh.
So it goes at six p.m. It's the people who fund the museum.
I guess I don't know. People were coming out when we were coming in, so they were like more important people. And then at 7
artists.
on Tuesday night, I think was like the regular important people, and then at 8:30 was these more regular important people, but a little less important. And then the next night, Wednesday, there was 2 stacked openings, and that was more for members and probably different levels of membership. So,
but the artists are mixed in with the secondary important people.
I mean, they're pretty important. I didn't even know until I thought we would be there at the original, like the first, like the opening of the doors, but. Then I heard that there was people in there before that maybe were funders and stuff. I don't know.
See, I wonder if people listening.
We got there really early because we didn't want to wait online. So we knew we should be there at 7, and we were there pretty much right on time. But the museum was already filled with other people.
Right, right.
It was an exciting opening. You know, saw a lot of people.
Now, had you just go backtrack for a second here. Had you had a chance to see the show itself by the time you had showed up for that opening, or was this your first time getting to see it?
For the most part, I saw a little pieces of it when I was installing, but I was one of the first people to install, and I was on the first floor that was installing, so I didn't really see that much.
Yeah. Okay. So when you went to the opening, then you, because it was so packed, you probably really didn't get to see it. Then even.
No, I went back like a day or two later and saw the show more thoroughly.
Right.
I saw a little bit. I mean, I tried to walk around, but then you'd see someone and they, you know, like you'd see your friend and they would say, "Oh, let's go look at your art." So, you know, it was.
So, what was the opening like then? Other than be chaotic,
it was really insanely chaotic. I've never been at an opening with that many people, and the level of. Like everyone wanting to get in there because they do the stacked opening. It really mattered how early you got in there. So and I went back on Wednesday night too, because, that's when like my friends could come. That's like more like the regular people or like the easier invite to get. So like the art people were there on the first night. And then my friends that I wanted to see who lived in New York came on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really know that many people on Wednesday night. It was just more like general public. So in fact, like, the sort of less important one was, in a way, less fun because I, except for the couple people that I knew, I didn't know anyone there on Wednesday night.
Right, right.
Anyway, but my wife came in for just that one night for Tuesday night. Like, we have a kid, so it was the first night the kid, the little kid, she's one, stayed with her grandparents, and Emily flew for one night and came back.
It was fun. Wow.
Yeah. But you probably don't really want to talk about the opening. You probably want to talk about other things.
No. Just, the reason,
you know,
no, actually, so what, like I was gonna say, what I was going to say a few minutes ago was that I was anticipating the listeners are like, why are you talking about all the... Because
this is like a sketch. This is like a really hard sketch of the hierarchy of the art world. It's like, you know, 6 o'clock. You know, here's the top of the art world food chain. 7 o'clock. You know what I mean?
Of what I hear, the Whitney Biennial does not mean what it used to mean. It's not as important as it once was. And
who do you hear that from?
The people who come at 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock on the first night, who say, you know, it's not what it used to be.
Oh, you're saying
the important people. Now it should filter down and let, now that you're broadcasting, and you should let everyone else know it's not that important.
but artists think it's important. I mean, artists think.
When I lived in New York in the late 90s, mm-hmm. and then when I was in grad school, I mean, I remember when I went to the first, I went to my first biennial with Shauna Lutker, who was in the biennial this year with me. And maybe we went when we were in college, so maybe we went in, I don't know what, 97. I think that they were odd years back then. It was before the millennium. We went to a biennial together, and we just thought it was the coolest thing. Like, someone gave us a ticket to the opening. Probably like the members opening, and we went with some friends, and we thought it was so amazing. And then we were in it, and it's really ended up being just like a very big group show that was too many people. It was too crowded. I thought there was some great work in it and some not great work, and it was just a big, messy group show, like biennials often are. So there's this idea when you're like in art school that it's really such an important thing, and really it's just, I think, important maybe to have on your CV or something. But the show itself ends up being, you don't, as an artist, you don't really get a chance to explore the kind of things you might be interested in doing, like in a group show maybe that is curated thematically, or you don't really have the same kind of choice you would have in other shows. You know, like if you were in a gallery or had a room in a museum, you might have more chance to do things. It's really a very controlled environment. So it maybe it's not a rewarding show in an aesthetic or conceptual sense.
Which is the purest, right? Yes, this is the purest.
But I'm honored
sense.
To be in it. Like, exactly. I don't want to sound in any way ungrateful.
Right.
I really did want to be in it when I was in art school and stuff. Like, I was, really,
and even beyond art school, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to be in it, and then I had some work in another Whitney Biennial, like a long time ago. Like, I mean, not that long ago, 2006, maybe, I think. Or,
you had some work in it. What do you mean?
Yeah, like, you know, because some of these, there's always these shows that are like curated by other people.
Right.
Like, they're kind of real hybridized. So I was in someone else's curated show, and then people are like, oh, I saw your work in the Whitney Biennial, but I always felt like I wasn't really in the Whitney Biennial because my name wasn't.
Right.
Because I don't think I was.
Who was the artist who curated you in?
I was in the wrong gallery's Whitney Biennial show.
Right, right.
There's always,
so
always
that didn't
like
count.
Threads and threads and threads. Like this year, I was in Simeo Text, had all the, you know, the pamphlets, and Bruce Hainley had written a text about one of my videos, and then that was in the.
So you've made your first.
So I have my like 6 degrees of separation or something.
That's only 3 degrees.
3 degrees. That's but there's all, and in this one in particular, there was a lot of that. So there's a lot of work, and everyone says that it was crowded.
Yeah, and I think it was nice.
Exciting. I think the energy was kind of exciting.
Yeah. And I mean, there was a lot of messy authorship. Like, you couldn't, you the person who made the object that you see might not have been the wall label, which might not have been the person who was curated in the show, which does get confusing if you want a nice simple picture. But that is probably a little bit more close to the way the art world works, or that just because the names on the wall are not really necessarily all the names that go into making a work of art,
right.
Which, you know, which is like, you're in a sense part of Semiotext it through Bruce Hainley. So it's like, it takes a lot of people to make that one room, the Semiotext room. And it takes a lot of people to make every piece of art in that Whitney Biennial, even though there might just be one name on the wall, even if it's just one painting, it takes hundreds of people, all the artists that person talked to and, you know, and learned from.
But the main,
you want some sort point. Of dirt or gossip.
No, actually, sure, that would be fine, but that's not where I was going.
I was just
going to say that the main takeaway, for lack of a better word, for the Whitney Biennial is that it point it's a bunch of arrows pointing at you as an artist. So if you are lesser known, that's going to be a much bigger deal than if you are if you have a certain level of establishment, which you do. But still, there are even more, that many more people who are going to be aware of you that weren't aware of you before. I think that's, to me, so that's as an outsider, that seems like the reality of it.
Yeah, probably more people. I mean, a lot of people saw my work. But you have to remember that there's 100 people in the show, and people go through these shows real quickly. And I'm sure it still happens.
Not artists and curators, though.
I think some of them do. I think that there's a mentality, I don't know if we would call it a mentality, there's a symptom of what the art world is like now. Fairs, so right. many galleries. The people who can are always jumping on planes.
Right.
That you, the close inspection, the spending a lot of time with work, slowly learning about something, just doesn't happen. You know, people were, I saw people who were in town for the opening of the Whitney, because I was there during that week when the Armory show is there and the ADA fair. And these people are really busy, like the important curators, let's say, or, you know, whoever, you know, people who let's say, matter. You know, they're like, okay, I got 2 hours to go to the Whitney, then I have to go to this, then I have this and this. And they go really quickly. And then when I went back during the Freeze Art Fair, you know, people don't, you don't spend a lot of time with work anymore. So I don't know. Yes, more people saw my work than other times, but I just don't know if that kind of thing that used to happen with the Whitney Biennial, where it's like an artist was relatively unknown, was in the Whitney Biennial, all these dealers came and said, I want to sell your work, and then they sold everything, right. and then they're on the cover of Art Forum like a year later.
But don't you think,
I don't know if that happens.
Don't you think there are a few, at least a few names? Because I remember like just glancing at the
there's a few of those
times online and seeing like a few artists that were like, oh, this looks like a find type of artist.
Who are you referring to?
There was some, oh gosh, that's really vague in my head right now, but I think a woman who's working with like sort of quirkily carved wood, if I remember right. Like a tree trunk type of thing. That's my vague memory. Yeah, sorry.
So she's not
specific.
She's not running.
She's definitely out of New York.
She's not on her way. I think to art stardom in your head. Clearly,
I think she's. I want to say she's based in Georgia. So she's definitely out of New York and L.A.
Well, she's not on the way to art stardom in my head. Okay. I think there probably still is some that does still happen to some degree, but. I found that the kind of hype around it and the I don't know what we would call it, the just all this stuff people just talk around. Let's say they talk around the Whitney Biennial. They don't talk about the work necessarily in it. They don't talk about to some degree they talk about the curating choices, but they don't really talk about the work in it. Most of the talk happens before and around, like, oh, it's such a big deal. But really that is very disconnected to what it is, which for me was, it was just a wall in another show. But I felt the pressure. Like I do a lot of walls that size. That's not so strange for me. And I was really happy to be in the Whitney Biennial. I was happy to be in Michelle Grabner's section, because it was the only floor ever in a Whitney Biennial curated by an artist. So I feel pretty honored.
Yeah.
But I put a lot of pressure on myself to like really, I thought about this wall like way more than I normally would doing a wall of that size. I was just like thinking, oh, should I move this 1 inch, move this? And that was all internalizing this pressure that I felt from the outside. But the actual reality is it's not as if, I hate to burst the bubble of the people who are hoping to be in the Whitney Biennial. It's not as if everything sold off the walls and Larry Gagosian was knocking on my door. I mean, there was a little bit of interest, sold some stuff. Some dealers maybe were a little interested, but it wasn't really...
So wait a second. So all the work in the Biennial is for sale? As if...
Well, it's all new work, so it's all for sale in that...
Through the dealer? Respective dealers or
yeah I mean all of the work in went through my LA dealer
so Suzanne. Your dealer sold some of the work that was in the Biennial.
She did sell some of the work that was in the Okay. Biennial, yes.
So that's great then. And I mean, the show is still up and then it will come down.
The show came down. And
so it just came down then.
Just came
that's
down.
That's why, yeah. Hence the ticker tape rate. Anyway.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, just late May, right?
Yeah, late May. You know, the truth is probably, I imagine no art dealer, or no art, there's probably no art dealers, but probably no art collectors are listening to the show, but you never know. But there definitely were people who wanted to buy stuff just because it was in the Whitney Biennial. Because there was, it was basically, I don't want to get into much detail
sure.
because people would get angry. But yes, people do want that. And I've heard that from other artists too. It's like, oh, this is going to be in it. Yeah, I'll take it. Oh, that one's not going to be in it. I don't want it.
Totally.
But I think that is less so now yeah. than in the past. You know, the 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there was hardly any art fairs. I mean, there was, and so the Whitney Biennial really kind of served a purpose of introducing pieces. But like every piece that's sellable in that Whitney Biennial, that is like any, I mean, maybe a performance, a durational performance didn't make an earlier appearance in an art fair, but pretty much every piece of art in that biennial that could have been commodified probably made some sort of earlier appearance in an art fair, which is sad. But it's true, so I don't know if it really serves that kind of purpose of right. introducing things the way.
Right. Yeah. Well, going back to what you were saying about people not really seeing it, you know, talking around it, I'm kind of curious to take that a little bit further because, I mean, presumably the people who review the show see it. Would you wouldn't disagree with that, would
yes.
you? You would disagree with that.
Well, no, they see it, but I feel that a number of the reviews actually didn't deal with the work on this show. They dealt with the curatorial premise.
Right, right.
Well,
good point.
Because it was the first time, right, where they had three separate curators.
Well, it was separated, so it set up separate a natural curators. Thing where it was right. a compare and contrast yeah. exercise, which was mostly what they did. So they critiqued the curators, and it would have been nice if, I mean, you see less and less in art criticism. I think you see a critic saying this is good and this isn't good because that kind of value
Jerry
judgments.
Jerry Saltz does that, doesn't he?
He does.
And, he does yeah, the hell out of
and
that.
And I actually really respect him that he will do that.
Yeah.
But he somehow destroyed some of his credibility also by being somehow like ultra populist somehow.
Yeah. And being on a reality show?
Yeah, reality show does kind of destroy some credibility, I guess.
Well, for what it's worth, I
although everything
mean...
you hear now is real.
Well, I mean, I was a finalist to be on that show.
Oh.
And then I didn't tell any of my friends. And then I told one of my friends, I'm a finalist to be on that show. And he said, that will ruin your career. And I'm like, what career? Ha, ha, ha. He's like, no, you don't want to be on that show.
You probably
so,
don't want to.
I mean, I went to the very last. I met the producers. It was like the last supper or something. They sat. There were like 10 of them. They sat
really?
At this table. And it was someone I had also gone to school with at Cal Arts, who was in the film school. And you know, it was Bravo and Magical Elves, and I sat there, and they interviewed me, and before
Magical
I
Magical Elves
it was
is...
was a production company, and there was a fluffer. They had a fluffer in the sky before. He's like, I'm the fluffer. This is what you need. He's like, I'm going to help you get through this interview, and he's like, this is what you need to do. You need to be cheery. You need to be peppy. You need to be enthusiastic. You need to be, you know, and this was the final interview, and then it came down to it, and I wasn't chosen, and I think that they probably went with Neil Bustamante instead of me.
Oh, yeah.
Because we were kind of similar kind of background or something. And then...
Same. Did she have purple hair, too?
We had the same hair color.
Varying hair colors.
Yeah, I think my hair at that time was pink, but we had kind of the same hair. But I just laughed because, you know, I wasn't on the show. It wouldn't have been probably good for me emotionally at that time. But, like, I would never think, like, I thought it was just a performance thing and kind of a kick. But... it has a much, much deeper meaning, doesn't it? A show like that.
If you're just tuning in, if you're listening to the streaming version of the conversation, that was my co-host Margie Schnibbe telling about her experience with not getting on to the Art Star reality show.
No, Bravo Work of Art, different. Art
oh.
Star was the
oh,
one.
Oh, well, that's the only one I know of. I didn't
no,
know there
Art,
was another one.
Bravo Work of Art. That was the one here. Art Star was the one that Jeffrey Deitch did in New York.
But you were, which one? You were on the Bravo, almost on the Bravo one.
Yeah, the one that the they one did that, they did the auditions here.
Oh, yeah.
The one that Jerry Saltz was
yeah,
a...
We are talking
yeah.
about the
yeah.
right thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. So, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
In any case.
But we were talking about art criticism.
Yeah.
And just what I wanted... what I would have liked more of the criticism to be focused on sort of like what thematic things did we learn from this biennial. And I think it was Emily Apter wrote a really good thing in Art Form about this sort of archive impulse, or this archive this desire to archive, and a number of artists who are working with archives, which is the kind of criticism would have been nice to, because there were a lot of themes. There was the kind of denial of authorship theme, or shared authorship. There, you know, there was a number of sort of like artists in the show. That would have been an interesting theme. There was a number of themes that I would have liked critics to talk about, but generally they sort of talked around the show. And, but, you know, hey, I was in the show. It's pretty great. I'm happy to be in it.
Just totally.
And
just,
yes, a lot of people saw my work, which is great.
Well, for just one final point on that, just for what it's worth, the only review that I read, I think, is probably the best review out there, which is the Peter Sheldahl review. But anyway, I don't know if you read that one, but he did an awesome deconstruction of the word practice as an art practice, which has been for a long time one of my pet peeves.
Little pet peeve.
Yeah. So anyway, if you haven't read it,
he used to write for Village. Where is he right now? Is it
New Yorker. Okay. Yeah. Check it out, Margie. Get back to me.
He's an excellent writer, but he is a bit old school.
That's what I mean. I remember from the Village Voice. And like,
well, do you think he was old school in that review in particular, though?
He does seem sometimes a little crabby to me. I don't remember. No, I mean, he did have a point. If I remember, it was sort of... the practice was like this, he was critiquing artists for the inability to sort of assert themselves and to sort of have mastery and authorship. And it was sort of like, is this right at all?
I don't know. I don't know if we should try to deconstruct it literally, because it's not like too strongly embedded in my mind. But the little that I could tell you is that there was something to the effect of the way that practice was sort of being introduced in school, and like that you had to sort of take on these certain elements, you know, in your growth as a young artist, was putting too much pressure on people, and they were not actually enjoying themselves, which I thought was a really good point. So do you have a sense of, Margie's looking at me with a little bit of
a
puzzle.
Well, I wanted to read the article, but I mean, I'm a masochist, so I mean, everybody has this, you know,
right. That's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point.
So I would have to read. I'll read the piece.
Okay. Do you feel like we've exhausted this?
Margie want to talk about something else?
No, we could keep talking about this. We're going to get there.
About Joe Scanlon and Yams.
Oh, my God.
Well,
was like, that is such a big deal.
Why don't you talk about this?
Well, because I don't know all that much about it, but I've been reading it because a lot of...
Tell us what you know so you can introduce it.
Well, what I know is that, like, on Facebook, a lot of women are very, very upset about Joe Scanlon and the Donnell Wolfer piece. And then Yams, I've been reading an article that they protested.
Yams, the collective.
Right, the
collective. Do you know the name of the woman who is, I mean, it's basically one woman with a bunch.
I can look it up on, you know, the article I was reading today. But there's all this kind of controversy about, and it's not really, what I read today, I think it was in ArtNet, was not that I guess they didn't show their film. Was that what happened?
Although they did show the film, they showed the film, I believe, at the opening.
Yeah, but there was something that
happened. And then later on, they were going to get their whole
2-week screening or something.
Because I saw it.
But what they were talking about, it was not, it's not because of Joe Scanlon, but it was because of the white supremacy of the institution. And that is like a huge topic. I wouldn't even know how to wrap my head around, but I think it's a really interesting conversation. And it's talking about the whole institutional system of the biennial, of these shows, of the art schools, of everything. And that is a very, very big deal, and it's a very big topic.
And if I may,
it's a really important topic.
I'm glad you brought it up, but at the same time, I think that's at least a podcast in itself. So
it's like a hundred.
It is.
Podcasts.
You should right. Yes.
Yeah, but I am not the
so
person.
You should get Joe and Yams on here.
That would be awesome.
But it's not just about Joe. It's about the whole institutional of the of the art schools, of Yale, of this is, I mean, it's about the whole system. And this is something which I wouldn't even know how to address. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine today about this, about the art schools in Southern California. I mean, it's I can't even wrap my head around it. It's too big, and I'm not the person to talk about it. I mean, I've been following this, and I don't even know how to address it at all. It's just too big. I just don't even know how.
Well, Carl, do you think you could hook me up with either of those parties?
But it's not just about not. Those two okay. parties. I mean, it's
no, of course
also,
not. Of
it's
course
also
not.
About, like, you know.
I can give you their emails.
Great. All right. Well, Margie, I'm sorry.
I feel that the whole thing, though, felt to me like a performance. It didn't feel like reality. It felt like Joe's piece does come from like a really, I think Joe's a great artist, but that piece does feel very jaded and nihilistic somehow, and it felt like a simulation of a type of work and not actually work, and it felt like the Yams being upset wasn't like she should have pulled the piece out when she saw Joe was in the show or at the opening when she saw the work. So she's in the show. She had a great time at the opening. She was in it for 2 months or 3 months. And then the week like before she was supposed to get her whole time, but she was in it the whole time and her piece was at the opening. She pulled it out at the end. But really, I think if you're really upset about something, you don't want to be associated, you pull it out in the beginning. So to me, it felt like very performative. Like she was performing.
It was a little disingenuous.
Yes. Joe's piece is disingenuous, and then her reaction was disingenuous. Right. And it just felt like so many things these days just didn't feel real.
But I think that the issue is not about Joe's piece. It's about the institution. It's something bigger than just Joe's piece. And this is... It's not just about him. It's about the whole system and how it works. And that's how the Yams on the Whitney and white supremacy. I mean, you can, someone, you know, I mean, somebody sent me this article.
We'll be taking that up in a future show.
You really should. Michael, have you recently been to Belize?
Belize, no. My parents went.
Ah, and they brought you
they
back
brought
that t-shirt.
Me this t-shirt, yeah.
That's nice.
I only wear t-shirts from places that I have not been. No,
really?
That's not true.
That's a great
but
way
often,
to dress.
I get a lot of t-shirts from my parents from places they've been. So this is one of them, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Have you been to Belize?
I was there once, yes.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it was fine. It was a ridiculous. I was on a cruise, which is a strange thing to be on.
Oh, right. Okay. So but you were not, you were kind of half-assing
it
in Belize.
Yeah, I was half-assing it. Right. It was an inauthentic Belizean experience.
Speaking of half-assing it, I think it's a perfect time to move on to the newest segment of the conversation.
I've only been on one cruise. I don't cruise. It's not a normal thing that I do. It's a long story how I got on that boat.
I believe me, I'm not judging you for being a cruiser. So anyway, this latest segment of our show, which we've had for about 4 episodes now, it's called Don't Call Us, We'll Call You. And it's basically stemming from the idea of the disastrous studio visit. It doesn't have to be a disastrous studio visit. It could be humiliating communication breakdown with a professional person that you're interacting with. It could be some kind of embarrassing event. It could be any kind of thing along those lines. It doesn't even need to be art related per se. That said,
that's
Carl,
different than what you said before.
Oh, Margie, for fuck's sake. Don't go K-Chung on me. So Carl, all that said, what is your don't call us, we'll call you?
I don't, you're going to share yours too. We're all share it. I have a
we'll
number.
See. Margie has one.
Okay. I had some bad ones when I was, or funny ones when I was in school. Since then I haven't had like, I have to say I haven't really had any terrible ones or, I mean, I've had a lot of those ones where people come in and you think like, God, I don't know why they're here. They really don't seem to be enjoying themselves or really want to be here. Like I had, like Zach Four came. This one was kind of bad. I remember.
Ooh, dirt.
Hmm?
So I just said, ooh, dirt.
It was not dirt. I mean, I name names if I'm going to tell someone, but it's not a bad thing. I was excited to have the visit. I think he's a pretty good dealer. This was a long time ago. This was maybe like 10 years ago, but I think he emailed me. We did it over email to decide when he was going to come, and somehow we mixed up AM and PM, and I thought he was coming sort of early evening, like 8 PM, but he was coming at 8 AM. I'm pretty sure I was right, and he messed this up. But then I get this call at 8:30, like, and, you know, I was asleep. Like, where are you, Carl? I'm outside your studio. I said, what's, you know. And then so I got my pants on and drove over there, and he was waiting for an hour. And maybe he was just pissed off for that, but I'm pretty sure I got that right. And he just didn't want to be there. It was just, and I've had those studio visits where it's like they don't say anything. You just think like, boy, did someone pay them to come here? Are they doing someone a favor? And maybe he was doing someone a favor. I don't know. And I've had those studio visits that were really great. And you're like, oh man, they were here for 3 hours. They watched both of my films, all of them from start to finish. You know, they looked at everything and then they never hear from them again. So, you know.
Right. But otherwise, all your professional interactions have been perfectly smooth, would you say?
No, I've messed ones up. Like, in retrospect, I've heard that, like, I messed it up. I was either too enthusiastic or not enthusiastic enough. But you have to, I guess you have to remember that, and I could give you some funny ones in grad school. We can go over those. But I think there are some people who come to studio visits thinking, like, I don't want to talk. I just want to look at the work. And I think that that's not really fair, because when people come in, like, that, you're not going into a showroom. You're not going into an art fair booth or a gallery. You're going into like a private space. So it is a space for talking. And sometimes you get those studio visits where people just, they just want to look, but everything on the wall might be unfinished or piecemeal. So, but also I think just like, I usually don't get too nervous about studio visits, but sometimes I think some people coming to studios could be nervous or don't know how to act. There is a certain, artists are so weird, you know, we're all so odd and different. It's not like the people who are, not like curators really could ever learn how to behave, because they're dealing with such wacky, weird people. Unpredictable.
But on that scale, you're an excellent host, so don't sell yourself short in that regard.
I'm sure I made plenty of people feel bad.
Really? Yeah. You think you condescended to some people?
I think I have. And then I didn't condescend when I should have condescended, and then I condescended when I shouldn't have.
Have you ever had, I had one where the gallerist, he asked me for a drink, if I could give him a drink, like an alcoholic drink. He's like, I need a beer.
Yeah, you should.
Because the work.
Oh.
Like looking at the work.
Did you give him one? Did you have one on hand?
Yeah. Oh, no, I think maybe.
Because I heard you're always supposed to offer beer.
I was like, no, it's in the day, so why don't we have a beer? Because wine will make you sleepy. I probably didn't have wine, but I had beer or something.
I should keep alcohol on hand. I don't drink anymore, but I heard that it's good to offer alcohol.
I mean, it was there, and then he asked for it because I think there were naked pictures or something. I'm like, okay, yeah, here. Okay, fine. You know? Whatever. I mean, I don't want to drink when someone's there. You know, talking about work, I want to drink sparkling water. Isn't that what you drink? I mean, I don't know.
Sparkling water.
Well, yeah. Water, you want.
Yeah.
You want, you know, fizzy water, you
right.
want flat water.
Right, right, right.
How about a beer?
That's the elegant offering.
Right.
So I had a good one when I was drinking. This was in school, and it was during open studios, and I was drunk. And most of my studio visits that were bad were still happening when I was drinking. I don't know if it's related. But this one, I was drunk, and Robert Chapazian, who used to run Gagosian here in LA, came to the open studios at UCLA. And he was looking at my art, and I told him that, like, he never does any good shows, and all his artists stink, except for Glenn Cedar, who you guys probably don't know who he is, but I think he's awesome. And he did a show at Beverly Hills. And I was like, Ed Ruscha's okay, but I don't know. I said this to this guy. What a jerk I was. A terrible. So, Robert, if you're listening, I don't even know.
I feel like I've heard this story from somebody else,
yeah,
actually.
I doubt it.
That's hilarious.
I was real. I apologize. I was a prick.
I wonder if I heard it from you.
Maybe he was amused. I don't know. He's probably a cocky art student.
Yeah, they probably love it. I don't know. He didn't seem to mind that much. He didn't care.
So, but since you said Gagosian, can I then show, because I showed you before this picture, we were talking about this picture, and you guys did the podcast where you talked about the three-way podcast where you talked about Urs Fischer, right?
Yeah.
At MoCA. And then when I was in New York, then I saw the...
But then we have to hear about Michael's bad studio visit.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But then I want to... What was your bad studio visit?
Well, wait a second. We're getting completely out of order here.
But what was your bad studio visit?
Before we do that, we should still stay on studio visits.
Oh, I see. So we're going to move on to Urs Fischer? Is that how it's going
to
work?
I just wanted to show the picture. I wanted to show
But we're on the radio.
Well, it's a gold pig fucker. That's a pretty good picture. You can imagine it's a gold pig being fucked by someone.
Okay, anyway, okay.
Okay, we're going back to your studio.
Tell us about your bad studio visit.
Oh, geez, I've had several bad studios.
Why?
I don't even... Yeah, see, the fact that you guys don't seem to have on your radar, and by the way...
I don't understand.
Well, let me just give out the number for people who might have their own Don't Call Us.
Oh, it's a call-in show?
Well, this isn't a call-in show. Kate Chung, it doesn't work like that, but...
You plug your phone in the jack.
Okay, well,
you can do it.
But I have a designated phone number for people to leave messages if they have their own Don't Call Us, We'll Call You. And that number is 424-256-6618. Or if you're shy, you can email your anecdote to theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. So 424-256-6618. All right. I'm trying to think of one... bad studio visit that I have that's different than the one that I've been telling people lately, because that one's a little bit too personal.
Oh, come on, Cher.
Oh, okay. I had a studio in my apartment in New York, and I had an artist, a pretty well-established artist that I managed to get to come, and it was fine. It was basically. It was uneventful, except for the fact that he sort of, I remember, made a big deal about how it was all part of the experience. Like, you know, you come out of the elevator, you go down the hallway, and, you know, and it was like, it was a little bit funky. You know, it was just like sort of East Village kind of funky, but it was all part of the experience, you know, like that you go down this funky hallway, you go into the apartment, and then the work is right there. So he was basically putting, it doesn't sound like
what
that.
What were you supposed to do? I don't understand. What was bad?
In that case, I'm basically telling you that it seemed fine at the time, but afterwards there was a certain condescension that was going on, basically. He was putting a nice face on it, and mm-hmm. he was completely polite and, you know, and warm, but there was definitely like, you know, this is a little weird, and in a way I don't totally disagree with him, because I was trying in some cases I was trying to sort of masquerade my living room as being a studio, you know, like it was a designated studio. I didn't actually live there. So does that make sense?
You know, there's some curators who love to go to someone's living room because that's what they're into, and there's some who will poo-poo it. So,
you know,
it was the wrong person for you at that time.
Yeah. It ultimately didn't make one difference one way or the other. But you know what you're making me think of? This is something that's been coming up with me recently, because I'm trying to get some studio visits going now. And a couple very sort of different people, one a curator or a museum person, actually, and another just an artist, have both said, you know what you need to do? Because they've both seen respective spaces that I've had that have been like very unimpressive / small. And they both said, you know, you probably need to like rent a space maybe, or, you know, see if you can borrow one, you know, when you have people over. So basically they're under the impression that you're not giving yourself your best shot if you're not like showing in this really sort of nice, clean, white space, your work that they can sort of back up in and not have any shit around and what have you. What are your guys' takes on that?
A couple times I've had, I sensed, I mean, you've been to my studio. I think it's fine.
Not your current one, but your last one.
My current one is basically the same. It's fine, it's decent size, but it is not like super impressive. And maybe once or twice I've noticed that like maybe a few really big galleries have come and thought maybe, oh, one of our artists shouldn't be working in a space that's, you know, not that big. But I haven't really noticed it. I noticed that actually people really like coming to bad neighborhoods, particularly Europeans. And like,
right.
like I've... I'm in Boyle Heights now, and I used to be sort of in Crenshaw area, and I feel that they get Europeans or Swiss, you know, like they have their driver wait outside in the bad neighborhood, and it feels very authentic to them.
Right. So however
they say, where are we? Right. Oh man.
And so however funky it is inside just adds to that whole experience.
I don't know. I think that the funkiness is part of it.
Right.
It feels foreign. It feels authentic. LA people don't care so much about that if they go to Boyle Heights. A lot of people have studios there. Yeah. But like when you're like, oh, the liquor store is there, and that is sort of like a massage parlor, and that's a church. And they're like, I love it. So LA.
Right.
Margie, that's so funny because I finally in my life have out of those neighborhoods, you know? Like, having been in them my whole life.
Well, you have a studio in your house.
Well, I work in my house, but that's pretty much all I do there. I mean, the whole house is where I work. I have a bedroom where I sleep, but you've been to my house.
Yeah.
It's not like it's like I actually, like, live a normal life there.
Right.
You know, I just
But you've never gotten those kinds of comments before? I mean, am I the only one who's gotten that?
I'm too crazy. People don't say shit like that to me. Okay. I'm just too eccentric.
It doesn't matter.
Maybe they think it, you know, but also I just work in my house. I hardly even live there. I mean, I have a bedroom. I don't work in the bedroom. I try not. I used to, like, draw all night before I went to sleep.
Right.
But, like, I can't. But I work in every room in my house, and my house is not like a comfortable living space. I mean, I put a bed in the front room for when people come to sleep there or visit or whatever, but it's not like I have been to, you know, artists' houses where they like artists who like have an apartment or like a house and then they have a studio. I mean, I work everywhere. I work inside, I work outside, I work in every room. So, you know, also, right now, that's only what I can afford to do. But my house is kind of big, so,
yeah.
I mean, it's fine.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's totally fine. It's just that
I would love to have a giant-ass space,
though. No shit.
Yeah.
I think the premise that I'm the conceit I'm trying to work with on other people's behalf is that some people are going to come in and they're going to be biased with, you know, because it's not like this pseudo-gallery type situation. And, you know, you want to have everything you can in your favor. So I get that. But it's like, no, I'm not going to rent a space so
that's
I can
ridiculous.
Have a studio visit.
Oh, I see. Well, it also depends on the kind
that's,
of
that's.
But
that's
work
not the
make,
person
too.
You would want. I mean, maybe if it was just a curator for one show, it would be fine. But if let's say this was an art dealer that you wanted to show at and you had to rent a space to look good, that's not the person you want to have a relationship with. You got to be honest. And I really think that people like funky spaces.
Does Suzanne like funky spaces?
I don't know.
Let's not
think
go
she
that
cares.
Far.
No, I mean, Suzanne, she's, I mean, I don't know if she likes, I think she does. She is perfectly fine with my space, I don't think.
Well, you don't have a funky space, so that doesn't say
anything. I have a nice studio.
Yeah.
It's just not a gigantic studio. But I think I believe in modesty, and I think it's good to keep your overhead kind of good, because I know a lot of artists, when they make a lot of money, get bigger studios, and I could have had a much bigger studio. I probably still could, but I just don't see the point in, if I don't need that much space, just like paying for space. So you're just paying for ego, like to walk in and be like, my space, which I could understand how that would feel good. But then when you keep writing the big check, you're like, well, I'm doing that just to like put my hands on my hips and go, yeah.
I mean, also some people they need if they're making pieces that are 16 feet tall or 20 feet tall. I mean, you know, I mean, everyone has a different situation. Like I also make videos. So I don't need, you know, if someone's going to watch videos.
Now this show has morphed into studio choices. Well, I believe you should make work the size of your studio. So you make it as big as your studio is. And that's how I decide, like, the dimensions of some of my drawings. It's like as big as the wall is, that's the drawing size.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that makes complete sense.
So, well, I think this is where I want to end this episode. And that is...
I have some more studio
Carl,
visits.
Carl, no.
Just thought about.
Oh, okay. All right. Do you want to get to those?
I'll give you one more studio visit. Sorry.
Okay,
I just
please.
Remembered this one.
Yeah.
This was in grad school.
Okay.
Chris Burden was one of my teachers. And, you know, it was hard to ever schedule meetings with him. So the first meeting we had, he's in there. The meetings are like an hour. We're in there for an hour. And he's looking at us, looking around. We're talking. We're conversing. And he says to me towards the end of the visit, he says, why do you keep calling these drawings? They're photos. And I said, no, Chris, they're drawings. And he takes his glasses off from top of his head. They're on his head the whole time. And he puts them on and he goes, oh. That was a good one, huh?
So, Carl, I want to go back to the fact that you're not drinking anymore. Are you on the wagon? What's the story there?
Oh, you want to talk about this? Oh, wait.
This is it. Yeah, we're wrapping up.
We're wrapping up?
Yeah.
I'm sober. I don't drink anymore. I used to drink and take a lot of drugs, so I don't anymore.
What was the turning point?
I couldn't get out of bed. I was depressed all the time. I had...
So you were a depressed alcoholic?
Yes. As it were. But I also had physical addiction to it. Like, my hand shook in the morning, and I had to throw up a lot, and I did embarrassing things, and I kind of didn't care if I lived or died, and... I was, you know, really bad shape. So I quit.
When was that?
I first tried in 2005, end of 2005, but I haven't had any drinks in 6 years, 6.5 years. Yeah. Because then I drank a little and then I stopped again.
But you're a private sober person,
right?
No,
I'm public.
No, no, no. by that I mean you don't. Do you go to AA?
I go to AA.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay, got it. That's all I meant.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Mazel tov, then.
Oh.
On your sobriety.
You don't have to congratulate me. Yes, I go. I don't go that often, but I go at least once a week.
I have a funny I have a funny little anecdote after we wrap up.
Do you go to AA? Is that why you asked?
No, no, no.
You're supposed to say, are you a friend of Bill?
I don't understand what that means. But I think that's great, because also, how could you make those drawings if your hands were shaking, because your drawings are so intricate? So
yeah, it was a bit of a problem.
But and you're a dad, too. So.
Yeah, well, I had people making them more than.
Oh, do you want to talk about that at all?
No, I think
Has that changed with the...
No, I always
had people working.
I had people working with me when I was drinking, and I still have people working for me. But I, at the end, like when I was the last year or so, when I was drinking so much, I had to drink to steady my hand to draw, and I wasn't really drawing that much. And but then actually, when I stopped drinking, I couldn't get back into drawing either. But now I draw a lot, so
brilliant.
My hand is not shaking anymore.
Margie, excellent job co-hosting. Going to do it again soon. Thank you very
much.
But
we do need to have the we have two topics that Margie has for future shows.
Right.
No, but it's we have to go now.
We're
going to
put those in the
up.
We're going to put those in the hopper. Carl, excellent guesting.
Pleasure
Thank
to be
you very
here.
Much. And we're out.
There it was, the first K Chung show of the conversation. That was pretty fun, wasn't it? I thought it was fun. I thought it was funny. Maybe I'm being a little narcissistic, but I hope you enjoyed it, and go to theconversationpod.com to support the show financially through via PayPal link or social media means. You can become a fan on Facebook. You can follow on Twitter. You can go to iTunes and write a nice review about the show to get more people to find out about it. And you can also, of course, do the Don't Call Us, We'll Call You. Still waiting for more submissions for that. So much appreciated. Thank you again very much for listening. Margie, Schnibby, and I are planning our next episode as we speak. And so we will be back on K-Chung next month and keeping that 10 p.m. slot. So give us a shout if you have any thoughts, questions. Don't call us, we'll call yous, etc. All right. Thanks again for being here. I'll talk to you soon.